Blog Talk Radio.
Radio. I'm Rich Ferguson, LA poet, musician, performer, and you are listening to Poet Escape. Welcome, everyone. Today, I am very pleased to have as my guest writer, musician, editor, and occasional roller skating rink DJ, J.M. Blaine. How are you, Jamie?
I'm well, brother. You should have put skating rink DJ at the top.
We got to get our priorities straight after
brother,
all.
Brother, you can put that one on the tombstone because, you know, when it's all else is said and done, that's the way I want to be remembered.
Nice. As likely to quote Axl Rose's St. Augustine, J.M. Blaine is a licensed sex and suicide specialist who has worked in libraries, haunted houses, psych wards, megachurches, rehabs, radio stations, and as I said before, roller rinks. J.M. Blaine is a nonfiction editor of the literary collective The Nervous Breakdown, a feature writer for America's most popular street paper, The Nashville Contributor, and a former contributor to the world's only religious satire magazine, The Wittenberg Door. Blaine lives in Nashville, Tennessee. Jamie, you know, it's a funny situation with us. We've actually known each other for some years now, have traded Christmas cards, you know, ever since the beginnings of The Nervous Breakdown, the online literary journal, goodness, which has been about 7 or 8 years or so now. We were a couple of the original contributors, but this is actually the first time we've ever spoken voice to voice. So I am really happy to have a chance to finally speak with you and to also celebrate your new book. Speaking of which, why don't we begin today's show by having you talk a bit about Midnight Jesus and Me, Misfit Memoirs of a Full Gospel, Rock and Roll, Late Night, Suicide, Crisis, Psychotherapist. Maybe for the people that are listening in that aren't familiar with it, talk a little about the book and how it all came about.
Goodness, you know, hearing somebody else say all that, it just sounds so crazy.
It's a mouthful.
I'm like, who is this guy? Oh, this is me.
Yeah. It sounds like one of the early Nervous Breakdown pieces. Those titles used to go on forever that we used to write.
It was. You know, I had tried to get into Vanderbilt MFA school way back in the day because I always wanted to write, and I didn't know what else to do except go to school and try things. And, of course, they would not let me through the doors. And somehow I had met up with Brad Listy and got connected with the Nervous Breakdown and people like you. And so that was sort of my writing school. That was my writing group. It was Circle of Peers and just a place to put some things out there and figure out what it took to do this thing. And, you know, strangely enough, you know, talking about being a roller rink DJ and working in haunted houses and all this, that was the things that I wanted to write about. But I found that when I sat down, the stories that came out and people seemed to respond the most to were stories from my work in psych wards and drug and alcohol rehabs and just this sort of side career I'd have as the midnight crisis response guy. Those were the stories that did well. It was unintentional. And when it came around to the collection for the book, fortunately, the good people at ECW said, let's just throw a little bit of everything in there. And that's probably the most accurate picture, a little bit of everything. So that's how that came to be.
Well, you mentioned ECW, and that was something I wanted to talk about because one of my guests on the show not that long ago was actually Jack Grisham, who also had a book published through ECW. Now, if I'm not mistaken, it was actually Jack Grisham that helped you to get your book published. Is that correct?
It was. You know, I think it's probably safe to say I probably would not have gotten a deal with ECW if it wasn't for Jack. I was the nonfiction editor at The Nervous Breakdown then, and I got an advanced copy of his book, An American Demon. And I was familiar with Jack. I listened to punk rock growing up. I had listened to TSOL.
TSOL, yeah.
And, and loved that group and loved their song Colors. That was one I really liked a lot growing up. And I thought his book was just great and just developed a relationship with ECW. And just it came from there, and I sent them some samples, and they said, hey, we'd love to do a book. And that's how it happened. But and it had spoke to Jack a few times through that. He sort of helped foster the relationship. And just I don't know where he does the demon thing because, man, talking to the guy, he's really seems to be a spiritual fellow.
He does. And he's
you know,
he's
such a
too.
Good guy, man.
Yeah. Now, at the end of your book, you also give a big nod to someone we both know and love quite well, Erica Ray, who's also a T&B contributor and was so from the very early days. What part did she play in the creation of your book?
Erica was an editor, too, nonfiction editor. She sort of brought me on board there. You know, really, Rich, all of you guys, Brad, Erica, Dawn Corrigan, Reno, Joe Daly, I don't want to leave anybody out, but you guys invested in me and really spent time with me and encouraged me, and you are the people, Irene Zion, cannot forget, and Lenore, who got in there and said, hey, man, you can do this, because I was, you know, really insecure. I had failed English, you know, back in school, so I had been told, you cannot do this. So I was really unsure, and that's why, you know, you mentioned that we'd known each other for a long time, but we'd never spoken. Well, you know, for a lot of years on the Nervous Breakdown, I used a fake name and never showed my face.
That's right.
Because I was too chicken. I was like, you know what, this isn't bad. I've always got an out. Yeah.
Right.
So anyway, roundabout way, Erica and I had similar upbringings, that we both were raised evangelical churches and sort of coming from the same perspective. And she was just very supportive and, man, just a lot of quality people. You know, you go into this thinking that it's this solitary thing and you're going to be this sort of lone rider. But like most experiences in life, you figure out it's really a lot more community and support and the relationships that you make. And at the end of the day, that's really what matters.
Yeah. You know, something that you and I discussed very early on when we were communicating by email, I think at a certain point in our writing careers, our writing lives, you and I were both considering going back to school and getting MFAs sort of almost around the same time. And
yeah, I think so.
the way you talk about the Nervous Breakdown now is actually, you know, kind of the way I feel about it. In a way, it was its own sort of MFA program, more so I think in the early days, you know, because it was such a new venture. And everyone was just kind of trying, you know, just throwing stuff against the wall, see what stuck. It really was almost like an MFA program, you know, just a really nice situation where we could bounce ideas off one another, trade ideas, and along the way becoming better writers. And, you know, I'll always be grateful to Brad Listy for a community like that, a community of people who, you know, a lot of people becoming friends, some great writers. I mean, it's gotten so big now, it's kind of, you know, become something else. It's, you know, really quite interesting to see its growth over the years. But in those early days, it was really quite amazing, and, you know, very fortunate, I feel, to have met people like you. You know, music is something that's very important to you, and this is something that I've known about you through the years. And one of the things I love about your book is that in some form or another, music runs through your entire book. One thing you have in your book, in fact, that I really love, I haven't really seen before, you have a soundtrack playlist in the back of the book where you say, this is a song I was listening to when I wrote this part of the book. Here's a song I was listening to that helped to influence this part of the book. I was hoping you could talk about your connection to music, when it all started, and where music has taken you through the years. And also, maybe just the importance of music when writing this book.
Man, you know, I started playing, you know, instruments very young, and you know, in my opening chapter in the book there, which sort of sets up the story where I'm in this treehouse with this girl who's working at a psychiatric group home, and she's asking me, how did you get into this? What did you, you know, what did you do? But the original question is you look like a musician, which I guess I do. And she asked what I liked, and I was telling her, I said, I like everything. You know, I love opera. I love heavy metal. I love country. I love R&B. I love rap. I love, you know, I love it all. And she said, everything. And I said, well, I don't particularly love that Billy Joel song about the Uptown Girl. But pretty much outside of that, I love it all. But, you know, I found when I was getting down in those places to write, man, unfortunately, I didn't keep journals or anything like that when I was younger. And was working a lot in the psych wards and the skating rinks and doing these things. And I kind of mentioned it in the book, but, you know, whether it's just through time passing or these multiple concussions that I've had, I can't remember a lot of those things. So what I would have to depend on is the music to take me into that certain mood and into that certain place. Sometimes it was a song that would remind me of that. Other times I would write to something that just created the mood. It would be very cinematic, and it would be maybe I would write a lot to the ambient band Hammock, which is from Nashville. There's another
guy. Oh, they're from Nashville.
Called,
I didn't know that. I was very pleased to not to interrupt you, but I was one of the things that I loved was at the end of the book, you mentioned particular bands, and then you say sort of all incidental music by Hammock. And Hammock is one of my favorite bands. I had no idea they were from Nashville.
I love those guys, man. They are so – I depended on those guys so much for this book. And the whole time I thought they were from England. And then I get to the end of the book and find out they're like 10 miles from my house. So it was a nice surprise. And we've corresponded some good guys, and I'm hoping that we can do some more work together in the future on some things. But Brian Eno, I would use that to create a certain mood because I had to get into that place. You know, like most of us, we've got other jobs and other lives. And so when I sit down to write, I need to get into that place and get everything out and just be there so I can write from that perspective. And, man, you have to depend on music. Probably a better, a precise example, when I used to work at the I worked nights at the psych ward, and it would just be absolute chaos sometimes, and they would call me in early, and I would know that it was just going to be nuts. And I would get there, and before I would walk through the doors, you know, I would sit there and sort of steel myself for what was coming. And I would listen to either War Pigs or Children of the Grave by Black Sabbath.
Nice.
Because, well, that would just create that sort of I am about to go into insanity. So when I sat down to write some of those stories, I definitely had to get back into War Pigs. It got me right there. So,
nice.
Yeah, it's always good to write to Motorhead. Man, Motorhead, AC/DC, Lynyrd Skynyrd, that's just good stuff to write to.
Nice. You know, something you were just saying made me think of a question. Both of us, we appreciate the power of music and how it can trigger memories and things. In going out on any of your calls as either a suicide specialist or whatever, have you ever used music out in the field if you've encountered someone flipping out? Have you ever just like, you know, said, hey, check this out, and played them some music to try to calm them down or anything?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when you go out in a situation like that, you have to look for any connection that you can find. And I didn't have a lot of confidence in my psychiatric skills either. I went to grad school very young, got a master's. I studied behavioral psychology but ended up getting my master's in counselor education because of some screwy things. And ended up getting a free ride through grad school because I used to skate with the dean's daughter. So there's your – it's
nice.
All in the book. But either way, I got out of grad school very young. I didn't have a lot of confidence. So I just was winging it. And the only way I knew how to wing it was go and be very humble, very unassuming, very down to earth, and just look for whatever connection with a person that I could. And music is such a great way to connect with people. And pretty much anything, you know, if that person liked country music, I could find something to connect with about it. If they were an old rock and roller, man, definitely. Let's, you know, let's talk about Ozzy. If, you know, no matter what they liked, I could find a place in there, usually somewhere to connect. So, yeah, music was, my gosh, I don't know what I would have done, you know, if not for the music.
Yeah.
So, absolutely.
Yeah. So you also have experience as a songwriter, and I'm curious, how would you say your lyrical abilities and poetic abilities have helped to shape your writing and the way you approach prose?
You know, that is, this is Poetescape. You know, and originally I thought, yeah, you know, I don't know if I'm much of a poet. But coming into Nashville, and I never had any, you know, great success as a songwriter. I happened to be friends with some really successful songwriters, and they would let me write with them and teach them. And I found out pretty quickly that really wasn't my forte, but, man, the experience was so valuable in that songwriting, especially the sort of Nashville brand of songwriting. The words have so much weight. You can't waste not one word. Every yeah. word has to move the story forward. And you really have to pay attention to the gravity of every word. And I think I took that into writing. I tried to, certainly. And that was just the power and the weight of the words. Use them sparingly. And it sort of goes with the old Strunk and White thing, you know, omit all needless words.
Right. You know,
so that's what
of,
I got from
yeah.
songwriting and what I nice. What I tried to take into it, yeah.
Speaking of the gravity and weight of words, as you just said so beautifully, and also about omitting what you don't need, you know, you have a section of the book at the end called Outtakes. And in the Outtakes section, there's a beautiful piece entitled Forever and Story, a piece that you wrote for your wife, which is actually really quite touching. How did you decide
yeah.
what went into the book and what didn't?
That's a tough one. I guess it was okay for me to, it was one thing for me to write about somebody else's story, whether I went out and saw them at a jail or emergency room in their worst moment or really struggled. But I had a number of people that I trusted in the process who said, you need to put yourself out there a little bit. You got to take some risk for yourself. You can't just be standoffish in this process. So writing about my life and writing about my wife, it was a risk and it was uncomfortable. But I think I showed it to enough people who said, wow, this is really something that you should include. Plus, man, I mean, gosh, you really want to take the opportunity. You got a book out there, you really want to take the opportunity to say something nice about your wife if you can.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, she brought such, if you tell the story through the book, it was just me really trying to come to terms with, you know, with the things I think we all struggle with. Man, who am I? And what am I supposed to do in this life? And what really matters and what counts? And how do I do that and not lose who I am? And, you know, I think we find that we need other people and we need that balance and we need the perspective that other people bring. You can't just do it by yourself. And so she definitely taught me that in a lot of ways and still teaches me that. And just such a gracious person. And so it's hard for me to even talk about it live and in person and be articulate and not get kind of goofy about it.
Sure,
but I appreciate you saying that, my friends. I appreciate it.
It really was a beautiful piece. In fact, I'm getting goosebumps right now thinking about it. It was really quite touching that you included it in the book, because so much of it is kind of dark, and then you have this really lovely piece at the end. It was like, wow, that's a really nice touch. You know,
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I wanted to say contrast is important. I think contrast makes things interesting, and you can't just have darkness, darkness, darkness. And that's why I think, you know, I may tell a story of suicide or drug addiction, but then I would, you know, well, let me tell a story from the skating rink, because I had to have that contrast and balance in life, or I would have lost my mind. So.
Yeah.
That's just what I wanted to say, that about contrast, and you got to have a little darkness and light to make it interesting.
Yeah, you know, something in addition to the music, something that runs throughout the book, and you've been touching on it in what you've been talking about, psychology. And to kind of bring the ideas of psychology and music together, there's a great section in your book early on when you're DJing, and depending on the song you were playing, you were literally able to control or almost manipulate people's moves and emotions. And it obviously told me a lot that you had gained a lot of insight into how different types of music affect people in different ways. Would you say that that was, in a way, the beginnings of, you know, studies of human psychology, or how would you bring those two things together?
You know, man, writing this book gave me a lot of peace about working in psychology and choosing that. And it would sound kind of crazy to say I never had that before, but it was something I'd always struggled with. I never grew up imagining myself as a counselor or a therapist or, geez, I mean, that was not cool, you know. I would have much rather just been the guy that was a DJ at the skating rink or, you know. And so I always struggled with that. I never picked it. The doors were just open. But when I started looking back, I was like, you know, even when I was too young to get in the bar and I was the DJ, I was still sort of a behavioral psychologist. You know, I was studying people. I was watching behavior. I was watching how things influenced people. And I've always loved to watch people and study people. And, you know, believe it or not, I really don't think I realized that until I sat down and put the pieces of this book together. And so that was a nice little side bonus, you know, it's kind of making peace with those things.
Yeah. You know, sticking on this psychology idea for a moment, there's a passage in the book where your pastor tells you, and I quote, "Psychology is fine and good, but don't let those crackpots get your mind all messed up," to which you reply, "Pastor, they say the same thing about you." I'm curious.
They did.
I'm curious, how do you balance your own thoughts between psychology and religion? Because I know religion is something that plays a big part in your life. You've written about it quite a bit. How do you balance those two things?
You know, I think if you think about it right, one complements the other. You know, in the South, and I don't want to get so definitional about this that it kind of loses the point, but I got to think about this one, and I know we're on the radio.
That's fine.
We really don't talk about religion a lot, and I don't want to be one of those people who say, oh, I'm not religious, I'm spiritual. It's just different definitions about things. But, you know, probably in some way I would have to answer it like this. I was studying behavioral psychology, and I was going to a Pentecostal church, and both of them were full of crazy, unbalanced people. Well, I love to watch crazy, unbalanced people. I always have. So looking back, it was a pretty fertile ground for that, if you were interested in human behavior. So, you know, I'm working at the psych ward and just left and right seeing these counselors and social workers. I'm admitting them into the psych ward and the drug rehab. I'm admitting people from my church left and right into the psych ward and the drug rehab. And I think at some point, even though I was just a kid and an immature one at that, I started to have this epiphany of, wow, some of this is really nuts.
Right.
So then when you get that, you have to sift it out and say, okay, well, I think it's probably worth some time and attention to figure out what is the good stuff here and what's the stuff that drives you crazy. So that's probably about the most articulate answer I can come up with on that one, man.
Sure. You know, we've been talking about music a lot, and there's a passage in your book that deals with one of my absolute music heroes, Neil Peart, the drummer. In fact, he was one of the guys that got me interested in first playing music, first playing the drums.
Me
and,
too.
Yeah, well, really?
Absolutely.
Nice.
Now, however much time we have left, we can talk about Rush, right?
Absolutely. I was one of those writers of at the Nervous Breakdown who always got shit for liking Rush, but I stand by them, man.
I'll be right in there with you, brother.
Yeah, I actually got a chance to meet Neil once in person, and let me tell you, I felt like a teenager, just a giddy teenager. It was great. Anyway, I'd love it if you could read a section of that story. If you want to set it up in any way, go for it.
Yeah, let me set it up. I'm not one of those readers that likes to read 8 pages from their books. So this is when I was working the crisis, and basically the way crisis works is when somebody calls a helpline, they would patch it through to me, and then I would talk to this person and dispatch out to their location to either set up to admit them into a hospital, get them an appointment, just help in any way that I could. And so this was usually I work nights, but this was actually sort of later in the afternoon, and this lady calls and asks if I will come and talk to her son. And so I do. I go out and I drive to this trailer park. It seems I was always going to the trailer park. And it's a very sweet lady, very typically Southern, and it's just her and her son there. And this guy comes out, this big, huge guy, and he's sort of bawling, and he's got this ponytail and this big walrus mustache. And in the book, I describe him as sort of a cross between David Crosby and Ben Franklin, if Ben Franklin had played in Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Which I love. What a great description.
But just, you know, just sweet family, sweet guy. He's schizophrenic. He's not suicidal, homicidal, anything like that. And he's just been off his meds, and he can't get an appointment, and he just needs some help. And so I said, sure, man. I said, you know, let's go somewhere and talk a little bit, and I'll look at your meds and whatever. So he leads me through this trailer, and this is a small trailer, and this is one of those bedrooms that is the size of a big walk-in closet. And I go in there, and I mean taking up every bit of room. In this tiny, tiny room is this enormous drum set, kind of like 20-plus piece, you know, drum set. And it's like, oh, my gosh. And he's got this Rush tapestry hanging over the window. And, you know, so I'm just, like, sitting there. I've, like, forgotten why I'm there. I'm like, oh, my gosh. And so, but, you know, I'm trying to be professional and kind of talking to this guy. And he's sitting on the drum stool because there's no place else to sit. And I'm sitting on the bed. And he starts sizzling his hi-hat. And I'm like, yeah, yeah, go ahead, cook it. Well, you know, cook it is a drummer term. He's like, whoa, he says, you play the drums? And I said, well, you know, sort of, but man, you know, nothing like this. And he says, do you want to hear something? And I said, absolutely. And this is when I'll read from the book for you.
Nice.
Guy's name is Larry. Larry mutters to himself a bit and counts into the incredibly difficult drum solo from the live version of YYZ. Eyes shut, arms flailing, the big man plays like an octopus possessed, attacking the algebraic jazz rock rhythms of the legendary Neil Peart, peppering the piece with his own abstract improvs. In the close confines of the double wide, fills, flams, and paradiddles ricochet from every wall, at times sounding like a boxcar full of firewood falling down a mountain, an armory of machine guns misfiring at once, like the apocalypse led by the drum corps from a million marching bands. If St. Irenaeus is right and the glory of God is a man fully alive, then the Almighty has one fist lifted, chanting, Larry, Larry, Larry. And that's the part from the book, brother.
Nice. It's beautiful. I love that story. And it's so touching at the end because there's a section toward the end where you actually – Or maybe it's at the end of the book where you mention Larry again. There's a section of the book where you kind of do a recap and give a little bit of an update on the people that you wrote about. And I believe there's a section when you talk about Larry where you wanted to go back and catch up with him, play some music, and he wasn't there anymore? Or what happened with Larry?
No, he wasn't. He had an old classical guitar in his closet. And so while he was playing, I took it out and started tuning it up. And I started playing the harmonics from the beginning of Red Barchetta because, you know, I can play guitar a little better than I can play drums. And so he gets really excited about that. And so we play Red Barchetta, and he's just, like, all amped up now. And he's a little schizophrenic anyway. So, you know, then he's like, oh, man, do you know Bytor and the Snow Dog? And I'm like, slow down, brother.
Right.
Yeah, he was like, nth degree Rush fan. But anyway, you know, we hung out and we played some, you know, little simple parts of the songs that we could both do. And I set him up an appointment. And when I leave, he was like, man, please, he said, man, just, come back and see me sometimes, man. Just come hang out when you get a chance. And I really meant well. And I said, oh, man, I wanted to. And I said, I'd love to. But, you know, man, life gets away with you, and you get busy, and you think you'll always have a chance. And when I finished writing all these stories about these people, and I would show them to other people, you know, they would say, well, what happened to this person or what happened to this guy? And, you know, when you're the crisis guy, a lot of times you just don't know. So at the end, I offered the best epilogue I could, and one of them was Larry's story, because one day I did. I took my guitar, and I went back to Larry's little trailer park, and his trailer was gone, man. There was nothing there but just a patch of dead grass where the trailer wow. was. And it was, it you know, but it the message to me there again, it was, you know what, man, what's important in life is people and the connection that you make with people. You know, I love what Jack Grissom said on your show. He said, he's talking about the Rabbi Jesus quote. He says, you can say what you want about me, but don't attack the spirit. And the spirit yeah. is that connection that runs in through all of us. You know, when you talk about that, man, I mean, you know, people aren't interested in talking about religion. And, you know, there was a time in this country when it was very boorish and low class to go on and on about your opinions about politics and religion. I think we should return to that time. We're too divided. And, you know, we need to think more about that connection with people and do things while there's still time. And, you know, I don't want to get into preaching and all that, but at the end of the day, that's what I am about. It's find that connection between people, man. Meet somebody in that place, you know, where you go just a little bit deeper than the shallow surface. And I hope yeah. that just comes through, you know. I hope it does.
It absolutely does. It absolutely does. And, you know, while on the topic of religion, you know, I remember in some of your earlier TMB pieces, religion would come up from time to time. Religion also plays a significant role in your book. And there's a moment when one of your characters, a quirky girl, says, in talking to you, she says, you are one dark-ass bastard, but you write about Jesus in ways that somehow don't offend me. And to kind of continue on that note, there is a passage that you write, and I'm going to read from it because I thought it was great. You say, sometimes, though, I want to tell people to burn all their flags and throw their TVs in the street, to rise up for the absurd, to embrace the illogical and no-show the revolution, to stir them up to speak truth, raise hell, and fight the power to truly be like that rebel, Jesus Christ. So kind of continuing on this subject, who is Jesus to you? What role does he play in your life? And continuing on what you just said, why do you think Jesus sometimes gets such a bad name?
I think Jesus wasn't very concerned about getting a bad name. You know, we don't need to forget about that Jesus who turned over all those tables and turned water into wine and made a whip and fought those guys in the church. Jesus could raise some hell for the right reasons. And, you know, he was a rebel. And, you know, I love the way you can get so much revelation from old drunks and schizophrenics in the middle of the night. And I'm going to kind of defer I have a story in the book about this old drunk that came one night and needed me to send him to rehab. And, just out of the blue, he starts talking. It was late Sunday night, so he starts talking about God. And he says, you know, he said, maybe, you know, that's what Jesus was. That was God coming down here to walk a mile in our shoes. And then maybe after he worked in the carpenter shop and did all that stuff, and then we killed him and he went back to heaven, maybe he took those shoes off and he said, hey, God, go easy on him. It's rough down there. And I thought, you know, that's pretty good theology for me. And, you know, I got a rabbi friend that says the name of God is I don't know. So I like to talk about all the stuff that I don't know. Man, I'm not sure. I'm not sure what's real, what isn't real, what is and what isn't. I can tell you about my upbringing and my connection and what I think God is and what I think prayer is. But at the end of the day, I have to tell you, I don't know. I just know what I hope. And one of the things in the book that I that I'll stand by is the older I get, the more important I think it is what you hope rather than what you know. So, man, that's all I can do is tell you what I hope. So I hope there's something else after this world. I hope there's grace. I hope God walked a mile in our shoes and said, hey, man, you can always start over. No matter where you are, no matter where you've been and what you've done, there's always time to make new choices and make a better chance. I hope so, brother.
Yeah. You know, I'm going to...
Because if it's not, we're all screwed.
We're all screwed. We're all going to be calling the crisis line by the end of the day. I'm going to quote one of your characters. And in the book, the character's asking you this question. So I'm going to quote your character, and then I'm going to see if you can answer the question for me.
Ooh, okay.
Hey, Super Bible Boy, Tat Jabs, if Jesus is so great, why are Christians so crazy?
My response to that is I'm going to quote my friend Rabbi Rami Shapiro, who's a great writer, and he has a exegesis of the book of Ecclesiastes, which is my very favorite book in the Bible. But there's a quote in there that says, the more you do for control, the less you do for joy. And I think most religion is about control and about ego and pride. And I think when you really get invested in ego and pride and control, it drives you nuts.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, one of the things that you do in the book that I really appreciated, you start each section out with a quote. And
yeah.
Yeah, which was great, and really by a wide array of people. There's one of your quotes by Albert Camus, actually, by Camus, and
yeah,
which led me to think about a question. The quote, first of all, the Camus quote is, nobody realizes that some people expend tremendous energy merely to appear normal. Doing the work that you do, you know, you've seen all varying shades of normal and people that are, you know, far beyond the pale. What are some factors that you've seen that cause people to just check out and slip away?
Well, you know, I think it goes back a little bit to what I was saying earlier about the power of choice. And I think just some people just don't have the insight to realize how many bad choices they make, irresponsible choices. Oh, I mean, gosh, I don't want to go all grad school psych on you, but, you know, there's just so much of a debate of is it environment, is it upbringing, why do people lose it? I don't know, why do I lose it sometimes? You know, some days I have it together, some days I don't. And if anything helped me going into that situation, man, it was very much a there but for the grace of God go I. You know, attitude. I just, you know, I thought, well, how would I want somebody to treat me if it was the worst day of my life? How would I want somebody to treat me if I were suicidal, if I was addicted to heroin, you know? And I would just try to go and be that person. And I'm sorry, you're going to have to remind me again what the original question was.
No.
I think I was on the right track.
You were on the right track. I was just asking, you know, what are some of the factors that cause people to just check out, slip away, lose grasp of, you know, a sense of quote-unquote normalcy?
Yeah, well, that was, you know, I don't think it made it into the book, but I had a friend who was a tattoo artist and a biker, and he told me early on in grad school, you know, it was as valuable as anything I learned, probably more so than anything I learned in grad school. He said, Jamie, he said, I think most people believe they're doing about the best they can. And then I've absolutely found that that's true in life.
Yeah.
You know, people think they're doing, people get through the day. They do the best they can. If they need to take a Xanax to get through the day, they take it. And then sometimes, you know, one becomes two, becomes three, becomes four. You know, man, everybody's struggling. And in the South a lot, you know, a lot of my book has sort of a real Southern flavor, but I don't know if it's due to the church thing or just kind of more of the way they do things down here. But there's a lot of pressure to perform and pretend and be something that you're really not. There's not a lot of safe places to be real. And, you know, I think that makes for a rough life sometimes. You got to have a safe place to be who you really are.
Yeah. You know, one thing I loved about the book is that in talking about all these different types of people that you've worked with, you never come off as judging any of them. And I think you hit on, or at least I feel that you just hit on something as to why you don't judge, because you have this attitude, you know what, people are just doing the best they can. And that was one of the things that I really loved about the book, is that you talk about people in such a wide array of circumstances and being really vulnerable at times, but yet you don't judge, you try to help, and you have this understanding they're doing the best they can. So I really appreciated that about the book. You know, it's true. It really is. You know, sort of along those lines, there's a beautiful section in the book that takes place in a supermarket around Christmas time. You're trying to offer some money to a struggling family, a young family that are in line, and they're truly offended by your gracious offer. And why do you think it's hard for people to sometimes give, or for that matter, to even receive?
It hurts their pride. I think I hurt their pride. So
yeah,
they didn't take my money.
Yeah.
But you know what? I got it to them anyway, didn't I?
Yeah, exactly. And it's beautiful because later, shortly after that, you actually do give the money to another young woman in the parking lot or something like that. I believe it was really nice. You know, in reading the book, there's a character, Wookie, and he refers to you as a preacher on a couple of occasions. And you insist you aren't. But it begged the question in my mind, would you ever want to be? I mean, if Al Green can be a reverend, it seems like you could do something along those lines as well.
I don't know, Rich. That's a good question. Would I ever want to be an ordained pastor? No, I don't have any interest in that. Can you be a preacher? Yeah, I could probably be a better preacher being you can be a preacher being the DJ at the skating rink. You can be a preacher. Dude, that's where we need preachers, you know. You can be a preacher being the crisis guy at the jail. You can be, we need preachers that mop the floor at the supermarket, man. That's where we need preachers. We need less preachers in pulpits and more preachers, hanging out at the grocery store.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the only kind of preacher I would want to be.
Yeah. So as I mentioned earlier, you start each section of the book with a quote, and there's one particular quote that stuck out in my mind by someone named Don Miller, and the quote goes, "Wonder is the best worship of all." And
yes.
What are some of the ways that a sense of wonder has served you in life?
Well, Donald Miller is a Christian writer, and I think he's a really good one. He lives here in Nashville, and he's written some really great books called like Blue Like Jazz and Million Miles, I think that is religion. I think a spirit of just wonder and just interested in things, finding things in the unknown. You know, I talk about going out on the riverbank and riding my bike on the levee and going to Piggly Wiggly grocery store at 2:00 in the morning, and you know, whatever I did or didn't do in psych grad school or just, you know, I had an interest in people. And I think that if you're interested in people, then they can tell that, you know, interesting people are interested in you. So that's where a sense of wonder came from. I wanted to be out there experiencing things. I wanted to get to know people. I wanted to meet that person at 2:00 in the morning that was thinking about jumping off the bridge. I wanted to be the one that was there for that. And if you go into that, you have to be open. You have to, whatever you've got in your pockets, and I'm speaking sort of metaphorically, you know, you got to take all of that stuff out. You got to lay all of that stuff down before you go out there. Whatever tools you've got, whatever cliches you've got, whatever systems, whatever plans, you know, it's very zen in a way, man. You've got to put all of that stuff down and go in there totally blank. Because if you don't, you're a fraud. And suffering people know frauds. You know, they're like, you know, it was like at the rink, kids. You can't fool kids. Kids know when you're a fake. Well, so do old drunks, and so do schizophrenics. They know. They know if you don't give a damn. They know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you got to go
do
empty.
Too. Dogs do too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that's a sense of wonder in that regard.
Yeah. Hey, I was hoping you could read another section from your book, if that's cool.
Sure, man. Sure. I'll read. this is one of those late night stories, and this would be a good example of just wonder and going with nothing and trying to pay attention to detail. And this is a story called, it's a short one. It's one called Flickering. There's a hollow-eyed woman holed up in the back bedroom of her rundown house, wedged between the window and the bed with a .38 Derringer in her hand. "Ain't nothing nobody can say will change my mind," she says when I enter the room. "You really think you can stop me?" The trim is painted mailbox blue. The walls and floor are bare timber. Pill bottles and empty beer cans are scattered around. The ceiling fan is missing a blade. "No," I tell her, "that's your choice. There's help, though, if you want it." A peace-signed beanbag lies next to the bed, so I sit down into it. There's a jade-green vase on a shelf next to a VHS tape of Lethal Weapon 2, and above the urn hangs a high school graduation picture of a smiling boy with sandy hair, long over one eye, and inscribed in the photo's corner is his birthday, a dash, and the date of his death, a year to this day. The woman presses against the wall with her free hand and hangs her head. "It's just so hard. Tell me about it," I say. And while she talks, I watch this hypnotic wobble of the lopsided fan. With every revolution, the picture shakes loose, flickering, darkness, and light. After a long while, the woman asks, "Why ain't you at home with your honey sleeping?" The window by the bed is open and a breeze blows through the screen. "I got no place to be," I tell her. "You talk all you want, long as I'm home before the sun comes up." She turns slow and looks to me. "So who are you, anyway?" The air smells like old clothes and frying bacon. There's a TV in the corner with the sound turned low. On the late-night show, they're playing The Graduate. Dustin Hoffman drifts across a pool before an infomercial flashes for Thigh Master Gold. And then I tell her, "I'm the guy who shows up at 3 in the morning and listens to people with pistols who just aren't sure they can go on." She lays her head back and rests the Derringer against the sill. "I guess somebody's got to be," she says. A scatter of crows call close, then further away. She leans across the bed and hands me the gun. "Hold this for me a while, okay?" The pistol is mother of pearl and polished steel, its weight seductive. I pull the hammer back and stare at the slug, Federal, .38 Special. Shake out the bullet and roll it in my palm. "Okay," I tell her. An 18-wheeler passes on the highway past the field. Somewhere out the window, a radio is playing Smoky Mountain Rain. We sit for a moment, listening. "Ain't heard that song in a long time," I tell her. "I always did like that song," the woman says. And that's the end of that story.
Nice. That was beautiful. That was J.M. Blaine reading from Midnight Jesus and Me, Misfit Memoirs of a Full Gospel Rock and Roll Late Night Suicide Crisis Psychotherapist. Jamie, along those lines, what would you say the best advice you've ever given? What's the best advice you've ever given to a patient, and what's the best advice anyone has ever given you in the mental health field?
Oof. I'm going to have to claim humility on that one. The best thing I ever can tell a patient, and I think that I've ever said, is, you know what? The good news is, as long as you're still here, you can always start making better choices tomorrow. That's probably the same advice I got back. You know, that was the perspective. Because, man, when you know, the good news is reciprocity, man. It's like a pyramid scheme come true. When you forgive people, you get forgiveness. When you offer hope, you get hope back. So, man, it was just, in retrospect, it just worked together for the good. You give, you get, you help each other out. At the end of the day, man, you learn. We help each other out in this life. That's what counts, and that's what matters.
Nice. Nice. We're getting close to the end of our time, but I have a couple more questions I want to ask.
Sure, brother.
Before we part ways. you know, there's a part in your book where you break into screenplay, and it's actually interesting that you did that, because actually while I was reading the book, before you broke out into screenplay, there were moments where I was actually thinking, wow, this would make an interesting movie. Have there been any talks at all about making this into any kind of movie?
There's been a little bit. I would love to do that. One of my big influences, and I hate we didn't get to talk about this more, but, you know, I was definitely influenced by Pentecostal preachers and the cadence of their voice. I was going to talk about Jimmy Swaggart and Muhammad Ali, because I grew up just loving the cadence and the words they used and the way they did those things. But another big influence was screenplays. I never read a lot of the classics, but I loved reading screenplays. I loved Cameron Crowe and his style. I loved the Coen brothers. And that's also a style where you absolutely have to weigh every word. You got a 100-page screenplay. You can't waste any words in there. So it definitely stresses that conservation. So that's why I wanted to write one chapter as a screenplay. And to tell you the truth, also to sort of get that out there and sort of be able to use that as a vehicle to let people know, hey, listen, you know, I would love to see this adapted into some sort of series or, you know, something, TV or movie. But it was also, just paying tribute to just how much influence I've had from screenplays. Still love to read scripts. If I love a movie, I find out I usually love the script even more. So.
Well, you mentioned Jimmy Swaggart, Muhammad Ali. We've got a couple minutes. How would you say that those two gentlemen have influenced your writing, or the musicality of your writing, or anything like that?
Well, you know, Pentecostal, they were definitely into a different sort of art of preaching and words and the flow. And Jimmy Swaggart's talk was very much like Muhammad Ali's talk. You know, in the preaching world, Billy Graham would be more like Billy Joel. Jimmy Swaggart would have been like Jimi Hendrix. Just a totally different thing. And, just, you know, even from a character and a person point of view, I thought he was so much interesting after you find out he's been chasing prostitutes down Airline Highway in Baton Rouge. You know, that was interesting to me. It's like, yes, now he's a character. But definitely, just growing up, in around the Pentecostal church, hearing prophets, we had a thing back then in church where a person would get up and give a prophecy, and one of the hallmarks of a true prophet is their prophecy would rhyme. And I'll try to hit this quick, but we would have false prophets who would, you know, be this sort of very labored sort of a rhyming progress. But then, you know, every now and then, there would be some of these old saints. There was this one guy named Brother Leonard. He was in his 80s. And when he spoke, it would just be beautiful, man. He just had this flow and this cadence. All of those things influenced me. There was a cadence and a flow to the way old drunks and schizophrenics talk at 2 o'clock in the morning. And when I write this, I wanted to do that justice. I wanted to capture that. So that's why, and probably that ties into screenplays too, because it's what people say and the way people say it that's very important. And so in that term, I guess if we're going to bring it in the circle, poeticate, poetry, I wanted to do that justice, the cadence and the flow and the tone of dialogue and the way people spoke. And I hope that I did that, man. And I appreciate
Absolutely.
You. Appreciate your time, and I appreciate your attention to that, brother. And appreciate your friendship over the years, man. Definitely.
Absolutely. One last question. Again, getting back to one of the quotes that you start a section of the book with, this one by Jack Kerouac. Kerouac said, "And now he was settling into his life's work, which was the study of things themselves in the streets of life and the night." So what do you consider to be your work, brother, Jamie?
You know, some people gave me a hard time about quoting Kerouac because I guess maybe that's cliche-ish . But, man, that quote just seemed to fit this journey in the book, man, where I'm struggling with, man, who am I? What am I doing out here? And, you know, numerous times, whether it was on a bridge rail, whether it's in a jail cell, some country ER or some backwoods trailer park. Everything would slow down, get still, and I would get this realization, this is where I belong. And yeah. So that's how the Kerouac quote came in here. That was where I belong, man. This is the study of things and the night and the people. And to me, that was very much where God was and still is.
Right. So we're pretty much at the end of our time. What's the best way for people to find out about you, your book, all things Jay and Blaine?
Well, of course, they can come to my website, which is jmblaine.com. I'm at the Nervous Breakdown. I do some music writing for the Salon affiliate, The Weaklings. There's a lot of stuff happening this year. Another book coming down the road, which is sort of a prequel sequel, and the working title is Blacklight Jesus and the Apostles of Pinball Rock and Roll.
Is that going to also be released by ECW?
No, man, we're working with a different company, but I still love the guys at ECW very much. But we're looking to do something a little different this time. So working on that, a lot of exciting stuff coming this year, and just praying and hoping I can rise to the occasion, brother.
Nice. With me today has been J.M. Blaine, author most recently of Midnight Jesus and Me, Misfit Memoirs of a Full Gospel, Rock and Roll, Late Night Suicide Crisis, Psychotherapist. Jamie, man, as I said earlier, such an honor to finally speak with you voice to voice. It's been so long. Thank you so much for being on the show.
God bless you, brother. The pleasure was all mine.
Yeah, I also want to send out a big thank you to our show's sponsor for all your writerly needs. Please contact Tyson Cornell and the lovely Julie at Rare Bird Lit. You can find them online at rarebirdlit.com. Also, a big thank you to Tyson Cornell and Julia Callahan for production assistance with today's show. Poetescape's theme music is by We Voice Sing. You can find them online at wevoicesing.com. You can find their debut CD of Wishbones and Gunfire on CD Baby, iTunes, Rhapsody, Spotify, and Twitter. Speaking of which, you can find me online at wevoicesing.com, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram. You can find my poetry collection, Eighth in Agony, on Amazon or at Punk Hostage Press. Tune in next week when my guests will be writer, LA writer, educator, S.L. Stiebel. Until then, I'm Rich Ferguson, and thanks for tuning in to Poetescape.